Museums are in transition these days. They're being shoved around by declining budgets and declining revenues, by the proliferation of and intense attraction America has for light entertainments. And now, museums are being shoved around by Congress. Congress has said, return to the native people all those things which rightfully belong to them. So the question on this edition of Conversations is, where next the museums? If they're in a forced transition, where will they choose to go? I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for Conversations. Today, my guest is Dr. Aldona Janaitis. Aldona Janaitis is an art historian, she is an anthropologist, she is a curator, and she is the director of the University of Alaska Museum. Aldona, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. I want to talk first about Congress, because I think this Congress represents the most kind of shocking forced transition that museums are going to go through. I want to start as well from what I think is an odd angle, if you'll let me. Some years ago, an attorney, activist, lobbyist for repatriation, whose name is Walter Echohawk, said the following. He said, if you desecrate a white grave, you go to jail. If you desecrate an Indian grave, you get a PhD. With all that that implies, have museums, as well as anthropology departments, archaeology departments at universities, been very resistant to the 1990 American Graves and Protection and Repatriation Act?
That's actually a fascinating question. When Congress began to consider this act in the late 80s, many museums were very, very upset about it. Many museums and anthropology departments and museums felt that all of their artifacts, all the skeletal remains were going to vanish. As it turned out, Congress passed this law, and as a result, museums throughout the country have become much more sensitive to the issues that repatriation addresses. One of the most central issues, and one that is of profound importance, is a repatriation of skeletal remains. And without going deeply into the legal aspects of museum collections and the role of museums and, you know, fiduciary role they have to the state that they're in to preserve and collect artifacts, the repatriation legislation for human remains basically says human life, the dignity of human life in human death, transcends issues of scholarship, politics, research, and science. And before the act, there were some museums and curators and archaeologists and anthropologists who said, no, we need those skeletal remains for research. We have to have them. And the research they were doing was very valid. But people have changed, come around, recognizing that Walter Echohawk is right.
Mm-hmm. You know, what's made the difference? I mean, I can't see that anyone would say of your elders' bones, for example, you can't have them because I need to study them. And your right to your bones, your ancestors' bones, just like my right to my grandmother, to bury my grandmother's bones, has to be universally acknowledged. Mm-hmm. But what happened to that argument about we have to study, these are important sources of information?
There has been a paradigmatic change in the discipline of anthropology / archaeology in museums that I believe has influenced the way museums now are addressing the repatriation issue, which is in a very different way from the way they used to address the repatriation issue, which was in many cases very deep concern and worry. And I'm going to give you kind of a broader theoretical answer to this.
Good.
It used to be that, and although my degree is in art history, I consider myself as much an anthropologist, so I'm including myself in this. Mm. It used to be that anthropologists or archaeologists, art historians of anthropological art, would go into a community or go into a collection and do research and say, I'm the expert. Mm. This is the truth. I follow Boas's theory here, I follow Levi-Strauss's theory there, and you then present the truth. When you're dealing with any issue that had to deal with real living people, Very often you would probably speak for them, saying, I am speaking for these Indians in this issue. It's turned out, and this is as a result as much of sort of the postmodernist trend and the post-colonial era as anything else, and the increased vocality of Native people to speak for themselves around the world, the discipline has sort of had to stand back and say, what really are we doing? Mm-hmm. What is our ethical role vis-a-vis the people whose cultures we represent and study? Native people at the same time are saying, we want our say, we want to speak with authority for our traditions. We want you to listen to what we feel about what you have done in the past and recently to our culture, to our traditions, to our deceased relatives. And so this change in sort of what anthropology and what archaeology is really all about and what museum collecting and research is all about has basically begun to change people's minds from what they used to think of, how they were trained in their disciplines. And I take myself in with this. I also, my first book was This is the Truth About Tlingit Art, and I would never say that now anymore. And so then when a legislation passes, and there were many museums that were trying to modify the legislation before it was actually passed by lobbying, once there was a law saying, if you're asked, you give back those skeletal remains, people, there are many people in museums that I've spoken about this to, they say, well, it's the law, we'll make the best of it.
Yeah.
And actually, the opportunities for partnerships with Native people today are so much greater than they were before this repatriation legislation.
And this is just a one-word answer question. Is this a very positive event?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. I think so.
We'll talk a good deal more about it. This is Dr. Aldona Janaitis. She mentioned her first book. Her first book, and now we have to be able to find it. Yes, the first book was Art of the Northern Tlingit. It was based on her dissertation. It was published in 1986 by the University of Washington Press. It is held, despite her misgivings about her sense of authority in it, it is held as one of the seminal works on this subject. Aldona Janaitis, our guest today on Conversations. She earned her PhD in 1977 from Columbia, the University Department of Art History and Archaeology. Columbia also awarded her a master's in philosophy and a master's in, was that in
arts.
Art history?
Yeah.
Yeah. And her BA came from the school at which she taught and was an administrator for many years, State University of New York at Stony Brook. This is Conversations. We're talking with the current, relatively newly come to Fairbanks, director of the University of Alaska Museum. You mentioned Native peoples wanting to speak for themselves. You mentioned anthropology departments, museums in transition, and you say this is a good thing. Has there not been a lot of emotion over what is effectively a couple of hundred years of denial of one kind of person and raising up of another kind of person? The white man knows about the Native people?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Has this been a difficult transition?
I can't speak for Native people in terms of this transition. I even can't speak for anybody else but myself. Mm-hmm. But the reason I went into Northwest Coast Native art, it was, now I kind of am chagrined at my naivete, but it was in the late 60s, early 70s. I wanted to be a scholar, I wanted to be an art historian, but I wanted to do something that was sort of would help oppressed people. And I said, well, gee, I will become a scholar of the art of oppressed people. And I've always loved Northwest Coast art, so it was a nice combination of what I liked, what I loved, and what I thought was necessary. And so my choice of a discipline was indeed informed by a desire to somehow facilitate the liberation of oppressed people, stifled voices, and so on. And as I, in terms of the Art of the Northern Klingit, the reason I have objection to it is that I would go to archives and do research and basically say, this is the interpretation of this art, this is the interpretation of that art. Mm-hmm. And never once did I ask a Klingit, what do you think? Because this material was all 19th century visual material from museums. Then when the paradigm began shifting, and I began reading works like works by James Clifford, who has studied how anthropology and museums represent Native people, and post-colonial literature, which sort of says, okay, here we have these people who have, like Edward Said's in Orientalism, say that representations of Oriental people have been disempowering to those people. There's a lot of literature going on in the last 10 years about this. And I said, my goodness, here is yet another way, and a much more effective way, that I, in my position of authority, as a professor, as an administrator, by embracing this new openness to partnership with Native people and being able to use my particular administrative abilities to kind of say, okay, here, let's try to see whether I can help do something that you would like to do. Mm-hmm. And that actually is what happened with the exhibition that I worked with the Kwakiuth people of Northern Vancouver Island. That's how we got together. And so essentially the kind of enrichment that you personally get from being more collaborative, being more open, being much more receptive to sharing authority makes it all much better, much richer.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us a story. Chiefly Feast, for people who don't know, is the subject of a gorgeous book edited by Aldona Janaitis. It is also an exhibit that Aldona started working on in 88, 89. It was presented first at the American Museum of Natural History in 1991. It is ongoing now at the Smithsonian. It's been in British Columbia. It's been in Texas. It's been in Seattle. It's an extraordinary presentation of Northwest American Native art. You were set to do this. You made a phone call to a woman you wanted to work with, and she said to you, what? This made me smile so much.
Well, if you're talking about when I said I'd like to do an exhibition on the potlatch, and she said, well, if you're going to do an exhibition on the potlatch, you might as well come and see one. So there's one in November. I'm sort of, this is indeed the way that Gloria Cranmer Webster, who was my colleague and collaborator in the exhibition, speaks. And it was transformational.
Yeah. How is that so? Going to a potlatch changed your perspective on curating?
Oh, actually, this is something that probably most people who do any kind of field work experience, but it happened to me, so I can right. speak about it. You know, By that point, I had written a fair number of essays, articles, books on Northwest Coast art. I had been teaching for years, and I had gone to the classics, Franz Boas's description of the religion of the Kwakiutl, for example. I had taught this material, taken slides and shown people, students in classes, a mask, a dance. I had done all these sort of intellectual stuff that you do to teach and to research. And so I went to this potlatch in Alert Bay in November. The big house in Alert Bay is this beautiful Northwest Coast structure with dirt floors, and it seats about 600 people, and there are carved posts holding up the roof. The ceiling is just extraordinary. And I watched the potlatch unfold, and there were dancers wearing masks that I had lectured about, and there was food that was delicious that I had read about, salivated about. And then at the end, a potlatch is a display of privileges that embody a family's status, and the people that go to a potlatch serve as witnesses to that display of status. At the end of a potlatch, the host family gives gifts, not in gift exchange, but in payment for the service that all the people who have been watching mm-hmm. have performed to validate the claim to rank of the host. And there, the whole floor of this huge big house got covered with material goods. And the families of the host, individuals connected to the families of the host, would go around the big house with like wads of bills this thick, giving money out. And all my scholarly objectivity just vanished, and there I was, being incredibly impressed by this family that was giving this potlatch. And what the potlatch was supposed to do was validate this family's claim to authority and status, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
They have always, will always be, in my mind, this fabulously noble family.
Mm-hmm.
It's all your objectivity goes away. It's something, the other thing that happened when in Chiefly Feasts was then I talked to a lot of people, and people at the museum talked a lot. We brought people to New York to work with us. We went to British Columbia. And it became very clear that the scholarship that I, as a non-Native person, do on the Native people of the Northwest Coast, what I say about them matters to them. That's actually something of a change, because so many times academics speak to academics and write for academics.
Mm.
And here, it wasn't the case.
So now what's happening is that the academic provides one piece of the puzzle.
That's right.
The current people provide another piece.
Absolutely.
Their oral history, another piece.
That's right.
Their artifacts, another
piece.
That's right.
And that's called, that's the glory and beauty of collaboration.
Right. How does Chiefly Feasts feel today? It has been, I've read some scholarship about Chiefly Feasts, and people are saying it hit museums like a ton of bricks. It said, change everything. It changed the way you put these exhibits together. So, like your early book, it's become foundational.
Thank you. Actually, let me just put a pitch in for the show. It will be at the Seattle Art Museum starting the end of May and going through till the middle of August. And I hope that people who haven't seen it yet would get to see it. I thank you. I think that's very flattering. It's probably a bit excessive, but I think the difference that Chiefly Feasts made was that it was probably one of the first times a really big, really important, prestigious museum, an American Museum of Natural History is amongst the best,
right.
The first time that museum, a museum like that, did this kind of collaboration.
Mm.
And it's so funny because when so many people come back after seeing the show in various venues, and they say, it's wonderful, there's something, and that clearly it's touched people in a very special way, and I've never quite been able to figure out why that is. I mean, it's dazzling, and
mm-hmm.
Not because that I have anything to do with it. And Walter Benjamin has an article called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, which essentially talks about how mechanical reproduction has deprived artworks of their aura because photographs mechanically reproduce themselves. And it's a complicated essay, which I'm sure you know. But the issue of the aura, there is the notion that an artwork or an assemblage of artworks that mean a great deal to a community end up having an aura. And I like to think of Chiefly Feasts as
yes.
having that aura, which comes about because of the involvement, the passion, the engagement of very old people amongst the Kwakiuth and very young people amongst the Kwakiuth. That exhibition is more than the sum of its parts, and the thing that's special about it is that aura that came about as a result of the community mm-hmm. working on it and mm-hmm. having their voice very forcefully, loudly, and authoritatively being heard in the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just fabulous.
So those who don't know can know. Let me tell you about the book. It's called Chiefly Feasts. Now, the subtitle is The Enduring Kwakiutl Potlatch. It was published simultaneously in New York and Seattle by the American Museum of Natural History and the University of Washington Press in 1991. Look for the title, Chiefly Feasts. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Its editor and creator, Dr. Aldona Janaitis, is our guest today. Among other things, we're talking about repatriation and museums and a changing perspective museums are gaining on the people they have really studied.
That's right.
Yes, I think this is a good time to take a look at this. An author I was reading, I'll think of his name in a minute, Dean Pearman is his name, was writing about the Repatriation Act, and he said it's ironic that Congress created this change, was the catalyst for this change, and museums are the ones made to change. Because for years, museums seem to be the only defenders of, preservers for, the lone struggler in the battle to preserve American, Native American art, craft, and artifacts, mm-hmm. thereby culture. And the American government was the one who was working to force total assimilation. Is this an irony in this situation?
Actually, the irony is fantastic. One of my personal heroes is Franz Boas, who
yes.
was called the father of American anthropology, and he basically transformed anthropology from a very racist discipline at the end of the 19th century to what it is today, which is founded in the notion that all cultures are equal, they're just different. When Boas was working at the turn of the century, the first several decades of the 20th century, he and his colleagues described the disappearing native cultures.
Right.
They would say that these people are going to vanish. Their ceremonies are almost gone. And the goal that Boas and his colleagues at museums and universities had is to collect as much of the material culture, as much of the intellectual culture, like myths and stories and songs, so that subsequent generations could know about this cultural diversity that once was but is no longer. Mm-hmm. That was the founding concept of many of the collections in museums. We have to get as much of this material to preserve it forever, because they're all, the Indians, the Native people, are all going to be gone if they haven't already been gone. What ended up happening is that despite all these predictions that Native people were going to disappear, they didn't. They stayed. They flourished. Their cultures accommodated to mm-hmm. the 20th century. Now, there's an academic kind of purist who thinks that the only authentic Indian is one who, if he's in the plains, he wears a feather bonnet and rides horses. If he's in the Northwest Coast, or she's in the Northwest Coast, she wears shredded cedar bark garments. And
didn't live after the end of the 19th
exactly,
century, right?
Exactly. Because yeah. Basically, so much anthropology in the past has been based on capturing that pristine primitive, worrying about the purity of the culture, and any sort of signs of acculturation were negative and to be discarded. But mm-hmm. so the point is, museums had all this stuff that said this is the preserve of these disappearing natives. Natives didn't disappear. As a matter of fact, the art, the culture, the ceremonialism of the 20th century is in many ways more interesting than it was in the 19th century, because here you have these very creative adjustments to living in 20th century America. And so what you have here are museums that are following the old paradigm of sort of salvage anthropology, not acknowledging the vitality, not necessarily acknowledging the vitality of the living native people of this country and Canada and other places. Then you have representatives of those native cultures going first to museums and sometimes not being greeted in ways that they wanted to be greeted, because they weren't the traditional Indian. They
sure.
were people who came in wearing Rolex watches and carrying briefcases.
Right.
And so then you had a very strong native presence in Washington that worked with some sympathetic Dan Inouye, who's a very profoundly sensitive senator who deeply loves Native people mm-hmm. and the American Indians. And basically, since the Native people didn't get as much sympathy from museums as they thought was appropriate, they went to the Congress.
Mm-hmm. And got the job done.
And got the job done. And in the process, changed the attitudes of... I mean, I've had conversations with people at museums, you know, sort of the earlier generation, who are gung-ho for repatriation, think it's a wonderful thing. Which I think it is, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a writer, I can't think of what his name is, that calls all this that you've been talking about imperialist nostalgia.
Yeah, Renata Rizzaldo.
Yes,
right.
It's a wonderful phrase.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
The impact, and I'm hoping, I'm not asking a why is there air question here, but the impact on both white people and on Native people of the constant announcements of the death of Native culture have to have been extreme.
Oh, it's extraordinary. And actually, not a day goes by that some individual, somebody in the popular press, will make a statement that, you know, the culture has vanished, the culture is disappearing. And in Chiefly Feasts, what Gloria wanted to have at the end of the exhibition was a tableau of the kind of potlatch gifts given today, when you get plastic laundry baskets filled with acrylic blankets and plastic dishes and crochet doilies that look just like my Lithuanian grandmother's crochet doilies. And I want that there because I want people to know that we're still alive, and I want people to know that our potlatch today is authentic, and even if we give away plastic laundry baskets, it's quackoodle. It's not anything but.
Not Rubbermaid.
Exactly.
This is quackoodle.
Yeah, and actually what we did when the show opened in New York at the Museum of Natural History, one of the graduate students who worked on this with me, Judith Ostrowitz, surveyed people at the end of the exhibition, and she said, what was the major point that this exhibition communicated to you? And I was gratified, obviously, as was Gloria, that most people said the potlatch is still here.
Yes.
And so then Judith said, well, what do you think about that tableau of plastic laundry baskets? And many people said, well, I like the old stuff better. I like the
real stuff.
The real stuff. And then, but one wonderful woman said, hey, I understand. I don't like it very much, but hey, this is the 90s and everyone's into plastic.
With us today on Conversations, Dr. Aldona Janinas. She is the director of the University of Alaska Museum. She joined this university in the fall of 1993.
July.
The summer of 1993. She came from the American Museum of Natural History, where she was a vice president for public programs. Before that, she worked, as I said earlier, at the State University of New York at Stony Brook as a professor for many years. She began there as a lecturer, moved all the way up through the ranks to full professor, and while she was teaching, ran the art department, art history department, and also went into a number of administrative posts. Dr. Aldona Janinas here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, today our guest on Conversations for KUAC. Now, I want to ask you about this notion of continuing cultures, where the decision had been that, the official decision had been that a culture in the United States of America had stopped some time back. The failure to acknowledge that this culture continued was a failure to see a great deal that was happening right under people's noses. Can you look at for us your study of, and I know this is ongoing at this point, but your study of the totem pole as an example of a culture continuing through time and adapting?
Actually, yeah. The study of the totem pole is actually so multidimensional.
Mm.
Because if you just begin to be conscious of all the totem pole images you see here in Fairbanks, which is very far away from the nearest native community that actually makes totem poles, the totem pole has become the symbol of the Northwest, the symbol of Alaska, the symbol of British Columbia. In many places, it's the symbol of Indianness. I mean, you have... you have trading posts on various reserves in North Dakota that have big totem poles in front of them.
Tell me where the totem pole originated so people will know, and kind of what areas it's in, quote, indigenous to, so we know where it's gone.
What actually was so interesting about that is it's not entirely clear. Oh. What we do know is that when first contacts were made with the Northwest Coast Indians, which are the native people from the Panhandle down to Puget Sound, barely any of the first travelers who wrote extensive documentation in the 1780s and 1790s about the communities, native peoples that they encountered, barely any references to totem poles. The only one or two references to totem poles of that early date were among the Haida in Queen Charlotte Islands. The pole, there is a long-standing tradition of Northwest Coast Native art of having carved posts on the inside of houses called house posts, and they represent clan legends and family stories. The outside totem pole
indeed was Aboriginal. I mean, before contact, they did have them in the Queen Charles, but very few. What then happened was that the Northwest Coast Native people got metal tools, they got more money because of the fur trade, they began making bigger and better totem poles on the outside of the houses, they began carving them all through from Southern Tlingit down to Puget Sound, and fairly soon these poles, which were just a minor portion of their culture, became the symbol of these Native people. And then museums, when they began collecting Northwest Coast art, the best prize was a totem pole.
Well, they're so statuesque.
That's right.
Sure, it's a great symbol.
Isn't that interesting?
That's right.
Totem poles became, this is a question in disguise as a statement, totem poles became items of exchange between Native cultures and other cultures?
One of the stereotypes that current ethnographic art historians are beginning to handle is the stereotype that art made for strangers, tourist art, is inauthentic and inappropriate to study. Well, what happened is that after the great era of fur trade, when the Northwest Coast Native people didn't have much source of income but were already part of the capitalist economy, they needed to start selling things. Well, it turned out that people loved to leave the West Coast with little models of totem poles. And so you had this abundance of argillite totem poles, which is a black shale from the Queen Charlotte's being made, wooden totem poles in Alaska and British Columbia. And what these totem poles we now recognize are not just mere tourist souvenirs and silly things to put on
kitsch.
Your kitsch. Yeah, right. What they are were statements of cultural endurance on the part of these Native people. They were making art for sale, art for strangers, but they were saying, I am a Haida. I am a Quagyuth person. And so instead of saying, oh, you're studying tourist art, tourist art is one of the most fascinating places, kinds of art that we can analyze these days, because in some profound way, it's in those little model totem poles that we can see the history of Native people as these people accommodated to the 20th century. Mm-hmm. One thing I think is really important to recognize is that the notion that Native people disappeared or that their culture in the 20th century is inauthentic, it denies them history. White people have history. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, you can't say that we're inauthentic because we're not wearing the clothes of our grandmothers.
Well, I kept thinking, my people no longer paint themselves blue. But Scottish heritage is still a strong heritage.
Precisely. Yeah. And the point is that for ages, we could have history, but they couldn't. Now, when the hegemonic society can do something that people on the outside, or not empowered in that society, can't do, that is immediately a discrimination, immediately a way of saying, you're not like us, you're not equal.
It's the other.
It's the other.
Do you think we, get as a culture? Do you think we understand as Americans what this kind of imperialist nostalgia, to use the phrase again, has done to both us and us being the culture at large, not just, I don't mean just white people, but to the culture writ large and also the smaller cultural group that is Native American people? Do we understand what we've done? What has been done?
Well, I'm not sure. I know that in the discipline of anthropology and in art history, that's become the paradigm. Mm-hmm. The paradigm is figuring out what the discourses of anthropology, of art history, have, how those discourses have served to disempower Native people, and to figure out ways of reversing that process. It's a very liberating kind of scholarship, and it's why being a scholar of this stuff right now today is so exciting. Whether the general public will embrace enthusiastically the plastic laundry baskets, metaphorically the plastic laundry baskets, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There is this desire on the part of people. I mean, imperialist nostalgia is a fabulous term because there's a yearning to go back to a simpler time, a time when everybody had his or her place, when Native people were authentically Native and they were so different from us. And we could look at the noble savage. Right. We'd look at the noble savage and say, ah, oh, that's a wonderful, wonderful moment in the history of, you know, the history of the world. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. But complementing the really paradigmatic change of scholarship with paralleling the paradigmatic change is the increased vocality of Native people to say, I want to speak for myself.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting, to go back to the thing about repatriation, there's a monument at the Museum of Natural History in New York, which is a large, complicated shrine used for whaling magic of the Tchalnath Indians on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And there is some indication that perhaps it was not acquired perfectly above board and perfectly legitimately. I've written a book about this, which is currently, I'm just finishing it up, and I've worked with the group of Indians from whom the shrine was originally taken. Since it's British Columbia, they're not covered by the repatriation legislation. And I've had conversations with this group saying, do you want the shrine back? Do you not want the shrine back? Do you want the shrine on exhibition? Do you not want the shrine on exhibition? And they can't decide because some people think it's too magical, too powerful. It was never meant to be seen publicly. Therefore, it's better in storage in the Museum of Natural History. Mm. Others say this shrine embodies our cultural heritage and we want to bring it back here and put it on display because it's who we are and we want to get a sense of pride. And then there are many people in the middle. Essentially, the bottom line, there was a community does not agree, has not reached consensus on the shrine. It happens so often that when I describe this story to non-Native people, immediately say, that museum, the Museum of Natural History, is a bad museum, shouldn't have that shrine, and you should give it back, and it's bad that the museum hasn't given it back. I said, no, but wait a minute. The community doesn't know whether it wants it back. And it's as if they don't hear that. Mm-hmm. And what's so interesting about that kind of response is it's the same kind of response as the old way that I'm a scholar, I know what's right, I'm the authority, I can tell you Indians what the truth about your culture is. Here you have people saying, I know the right thing to do with that whale shrine, give it back. It's the contemporary individual many people that I've spoken to speak for, Native people. In this particular very interesting case where the Moachat, this community, has to decide itself. And it's inappropriate for people to have this response of, this is the shrine that they have to have back.
Singular response. And what you're telling me is that the future of museums, anthropologists, Native Americans is going to be a dance, if it's going to be anything at all, where we move together, adjusting to each other's moves, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Native people are going to learn a lot more about what museums are all about. I mean, one of the great things with the repatriation legislation is that there will be visits to museums from communities that will see things from their culture that they have perhaps never seen because in the salvage mode it was all removed from the community. Museums, and this is something that I'm really excited about here in the University of Alaska, will have an opportunity to help train Native people in the museum business. In other words, if they're going to get things back and they want to put them on display, we're going to want to provide them with whatever assistance they would like. Mm-hmm. And so as the repatriation process unfolds over the next several years, museums will become even more sensitive to the real living Native people who live all around the United States. Native people, in turn, will have the experience of coming to museums and seeing what the museum world is all about. Mm-hmm. They will see that, in some cases, museums can provide state-of-the-art storage and protection that they would never have. Native people will come and see conservators treating these precious artworks with such loving care and respect that they'll have a different attitude about museums. So you're absolutely correct. There'll be this wonderful kind of greater communication between museums and Native people. And, I mean, the other thing which goes without saying is that because of the paradigm shift in anthropology and art history and museum studies, and because of the repatriation legislation, there won't be any more museum exhibitions which ignore the voice of the represented people.
Yeah.
And that's great. It enriches the representation.
Dr. Aldona Janaitis, our guest today on Conversations. Dr. Janaitis mentioned a great respect for an anthropologist named Franz Boas. He's long gone. She has brought is bringing, this is current as we're taping this, this is a book that's in press, brought out a collection of his essays. It's called A Wealth of Thought, Franz Boas on Native American Art. Once again, the University of Washington Press at Seattle is publishing this work for Dr. Janaitis. It's, as I say, a collection of his essays, all his essays, right?
Essays on art history.
Art history. Dr. Janaitis has added to that scholarship two extended essays of her own. One positions Boas in the scholarship of art history and another discussing his impact on Northwest Coast art studies. That book coming out, A Wealth of Thought, Franz Boas on Native American Art. Chiefly Feasts, another of her books, looks at the enduring Kwakiutl potlatch. And then From the Land of the Totem Poles, the Northwest Coast Indian Art Collection at the American Museum of Natural History. That whole long breath is a title. The Land of the Totem Poles looks at the Northwest Coast Indian Art Collection at the American Museum of Natural History. That book came out in 1988 from, once again, a co-publishing by the American Museum of Natural History and the University of Washington Press. British Museum Publications Limited put out the British edition of this book. You're listening to Conversations on KUAC FM in Fairbanks. Do you think we're talking about issues of power and disempowerment in some ways in this discussion?
Yeah.
Do you think that, I should go back and say, you've written that museums are places of imbalance because
That's
right. they are collections of the empowered.
That's right.
Relative to the disempowered, that the disempowered seldom get to interact with. Do you think this change, the repatriation act by Congress and all that's going to happen from it, is going to change museums in that major way?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I certainly hope it does. You see, what I meant by museums, the lack of equality between the representers and the represented. Museums, including the University of Alaska Museum, are institutions that sit in privileged positions in our society. A university is a privileged place. A big museum like the American Museum of Natural History is a privileged place. People of wealth and status support those institutions. People of learning and with lots of advanced degrees work at those places. And in our culture, those are privileges.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you bring in a Native group to collaborate on an exhibition, and this is true of Chiefly Feasts as well. I mean, I was perfectly aware that this was going on. I didn't know what to do. You are bringing them in on your grants.
To your house.
To your house.
Yeah.
To eat your food, speak your language, and then they go. And you now have this exhibition or whatever, and the people go back to their lives, in this case in British Columbia, to encounter racism and social problems and everything else. And you know, I just don't know how to deal with it. I don't know how to go beyond that logjam of the institutional setting of a museum. Now, of course, with the legislation, Native people do have a profoundly powerful voice in the treatment of certain artifacts from their cultures, because the law says you shall give that kind of thing back if it's asked for.
Mm-hmm. Which is what laws do best, right?
Absolutely.
Bottom line, this is happening.
You got it. Mm-hmm. And actually, Walter Echohawk did talk about this legislation as being sort of an affirmative action kind of legislation, much like the civil rights laws of the 60s, which are kind of trying to right some wrongs that were longstanding. But I'm not sure how much the power asymmetries will be dealt with in museums as we know them now. Now, the one good thing about the repatriation legislation is that it's made Native people reflect, do we want to have a cultural center here? Now, the Kwakiutl have two cultural centers, both the north and the south area, and they really know the museum business. And these are fabulous museums, fabulous places to go to, because they are institutions of the people, by the people. They let tourists come into their house.
Yeah.
And so we are the outsiders when we go into these institutions. And I think that with repatriation, with the return of various kinds of objects, not skeletal remains, because they will presumably be buried or treated in some respectful way, but the kind of artworks, artifacts that are going to come back to communities, Native people will then be able to say, okay, we're going to build our own museum, our own cultural center, and it'll be our voice. It's our institution. You're on our territory. Mm-hmm. And that will, I think, help a little bit of the balance. And the other thing, of course, is that as Native people become more interested, and when the opportunities for them to learn about curatorship and museum business and writing and scholarship, then their voices will be more profoundly heard within the institutions of the dominant society. I mean, there's this Haida artist by the name of Robert Davidson, who has just written a truly historic book. He's a brilliant artist, wonderful, incredible sensibility. He's written a first-person account of how he became an artist and what his artistic problems are and how he's going to go solve them and what are some of the sources of inspiration for him. And this is a book that's going to be coming out, hopefully in about a year or so. Here we have not just... we have an artist speaking for himself. You have publishing in a good press. University of Washington Press is also carrying that, and Douglas and McIntyre in Vancouver. He is assuming a privileged position because he is publishing in the context of academic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to happen more and more as Native people and communities here and there begin to want to become part of this large museum world that we're in.
There's another tributary coming into the river.
Exactly. Beautifully said. Yeah. Right.
Dr. Aldo Nijanidis on Conversations. We have more or less 10 minutes left. I mentioned at the top of the hour that among the kind of forced march influences on museums were declining revenues, Congress's 1990 Repatriation Act.
Yeah.
Also, there is our cultural attraction to what I think of as light entertainments. We love Epcot Center. We love Disneyland. We love MTV. We love videos. We love movies. How can we learn to love museums again? or kind of in acknowledging that not everyone has always gone to museums traveling away from home or staying at home.
That's right.
It as the burden is on you as the director of a museum to say, hey, come to this place. It's a wonderful place. Is our museum going to change? Are museums in general going to change?
Oh, yes. And our museum is going to change, too. We're not going to change what exists because it's brilliant, but we will be building some more and hopefully accommodate to the changing attitudes about museums. That's kind of the most central question that all of us in the museum world have been kind of struggling with. People go to Epcot Center. They can spend 8 hours there, and they don't get tired. People come to museums and have museum fatigue, which is a true identifiable syndrome after an hour. Now, why is this?
Interesting. Why is this?
Because...
I mean, there are many answers, and I'm just giving you one.
Because up until very recently, museums have really not cared very much about what the visitor felt and thought. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a parallel in terms of how museums in the past were not particularly sensitive to Native people. They weren't sensitive to their visitors. So you'd have curators, a museum director, say, this is the truth about birds, this is the truth about Michelangelo, or this is the truth about whatever, and geology.
I love it, so you must too.
Exactly. And they have very long texts on the walls giving much more information than anyone in the world could learn and keep in his mind, her mind, at the time. When I first took my museum job at Natural History, a very, very brilliant woman from the Field Museum said, what you want to do is see how you react to a museum visit. How do you feel? How does a museum touch you? What do you want to read and what don't you want to read? And, you know, hey, I'm in the business, I'm an academic, I'm a scholar.
What
do you think that I should? And I don't. And I fail all my friends who don't. And what is going on here? The point is that, and again, this we could spend 3 hours on this question, because it's really fascinating. The problem with museums is that they do not take the visitor's interest and experience and comfort into their planning for exhibitions. You know, I don't like to be made to feel stupid. Mm. It's very easy to make me feel that way. So if I go into a museum and I read this endless text and I walk away and think, what did I just read? Mm. I feel stupid. I should have been able to remember that and I didn't. So what happened is I went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which has the best labels in the world because they are relatively short, they're witty, they're first person, or they're direct to you, I'm sorry, second, what do you think about this, what do you think about that? And I learned more about Monterey Bay fish life than I could have ever imagined I would learn. Okay, so the point is this. Museums have an obligation to find out what interests people because you have to welcome them. You find out what kind of questions most people ask about, let's just say geology, Alaskan geology, which is going to be part of the extension that we're planning for the museum here. Mm-hmm. People are fascinated by volcanoes, fascinated by earthquakes. What you do in a geology exhibition is you don't go to the geologist and say, tell me the five things that people ought to know. What you do is you get that information from the geologist because that's important. But you first interview people saying, what do you know about geology? What questions do you have? And you welcome visitors to your museum by saying, mm-hmm, something about earthquakes, because you did your survey and everyone wants to know about earthquakes. And so you capture their imagination, you welcome them in by answering a question that most likely they have, and they get a clear, understandable answer in a non-threatening, or shall we say user-friendly way, and they leave feeling good. But then what happens is that they've learned about this question about volcanoes or earthquakes. And then there's something far more serious, but they've already kind of gotten into the museum mode. And by the end of their visit, they've learned just about everything that geologist said that they should learn.
Of course.
But they've loved learning.
User-friendly museums.
Exactly, exactly. And museums that welcome people. Museums must spend a lot more time and energy welcoming individuals from who typically don't come to museums. People who are not as well educated typically don't spend much time in museums. And museums have got to ask them, why don't you come? What would make this museum something that you would like to see? I mean, it was such a delight coming to this museum in the summer because we already had a project where we had Native artists doing work at the museum. And I said, that's so wonderful because here you have people being welcomed in and are in the institution because they're brilliant at what they do and because our visitors want to learn from them. But that means that we're welcomed into the Native community and we want to have much, much more of that kind of openness to, in this case, in this community, the Native community, but all other communities too. And so museums can no longer sort of stand back on their pedantic
in their pedantic ivory tower, because Epcot Center will beat us out every time. But what we want to do is, you know, you learn from Epcot Center how people are comfortable for long periods of time. And then some, you know, the one thing that sometimes curators say or museum professionals say is, but that's too lightweight. Your labels are too short. They have to learn much more than that. And the point is, I mean, you know, they're not going to learn that, because museum studies have proven over and over and over again that people only learn so much from a visit standing up. Mm-hmm. The answer to that is, for those people who want to learn more, you always have the book, the catalog, the text, which sounds kind of not terribly interesting, but if the successful exhibition is the one where the visitor says, God, that's so interesting, I want to learn more, let me buy that catalog, because that has really a lot of stuff about this subject, and they can go home at their leisure, lying in bed, having a Sunday on the couch, reading this at their pace and learning all the things that, in this fictitious case, the geologists want them to learn. They will. But what you want to do is you have to encourage them and welcome them more than anything else, and be willing to say, you're important.
Mm-hmm. Aldona Janaitis, thank you. It's been a very interesting hour.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Dr. Aldona Janaitis. She is the director of the University of Alaska Museum. She came to that post in July of 1993 from the American Museum of Natural History. She is the major curator working with a number of other people in creating an exhibition called Chiefly Feasts, which started out at the American Museum of Natural History, has been at the Smithsonian, it's been at Texas, of course it's been at British Columbia, because it is a focus exhibit of the people's art from that region. If you are traveling in the spring, summer of 1994, you'll find it at the Seattle Art Museum. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Conversations. My thanks to Aldona Janaitis for a very interesting hour.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I hope you join me again next week.